From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down.
Johnny Cash, the gravel-voiced balladeer of the hard-living and the downtrodden, died early this morning in Nashville. He was 71, a 10-time Grammy winner who recorded more than 1,500 songs. Johnny Cash performed in a black swallowtail coat, part rockabilly rebel, part country preacher. He sang to America's everyman, bridged generational and political divides, and sang eloquently of heaven, hell, and a world that isn't pretty. Tonight on Point, remembering Johnny Cash.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
How do you remember The Man in Black from a late-night jukebox, A Kiss in the El Camino? What do you hear in that deep, bleak, bare-bones voice of Johnny Cash? And have you known The Ring of Fire? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK.
Oh, but the fire went wild. I fell into a burning ring of fire.
Joining me now from Nashville is Brian Mansfield, Nashville correspondent for USA Today and author of the upcoming book, Ring of Fire, a biography of Johnny Cash. Good evening and welcome, Brian Mansfield.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Great to have you with us, and congratulations on your newborn down there, Brian.
Oh, thank you.
Also joining us tonight from New Orleans is Nick Spitzer, producer and host of the public radio series American Roots and professor of folklore at the University of New Orleans. Good evening, and a special welcome, Nick Spitzer. Great to have you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Terrific to have you both. Brian, take us to Nashville today. We've all heard so much about Johnny Cash on this day, a sad day of his death, and yet a day that everybody wants to talk about Johnny Cash and remember that music and think about exactly what it was that he brought to American music. But he was such a fixture in Nashville. What's the scene there today?
Just absolute shock. I mean, this is the passing of the single greatest figure in the history of country music. The only things that I can think of that even compare in terms of the emotional state of people around here is when Elvis died or when John Lennon was killed.
And Nick Spitzer, the greatest is a word that gets put on here very quickly, and nobody seems to push back against it. Nobody at all. What was it about Johnny Cash that puts him right up at the top of that very, very big pyramid of singers and performers?
It's funny you say pyramid. Someone today said to me he's in the Mount Rushmore of American music, and I think he is.
He's got the profile for it.
Yeah, why do we use those metaphors for him and say these things? I think it's because his life arc is so amazing, coming out of the Depression, 40 acres and a mule, coming into town after deciding he was going to be a singer, I guess, mainly in the Air Force, and getting his band together, and bringing the rural white country music into black urban music, and being in rockabilly, but also then later being in the folk movement, singing songs that feel like protest songs, singing straight ahead country music, and towards the end of his career, working with the sort of new rock crowd in a variety of formats, and in all that, embracing gospel, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, rockabilly, old time country, modern country, just embracing lots of different styles and embracing a lot of different emotional moods and political perspectives. So when anyone can condense all those things, they really reach a lot of people across lots of lines.
And do it with such a distinctive voice and delivery and all the rest. Brian Mansfield, it seems like, it was just a few months ago that we were sitting here on a Friday night at the passing of June Carter Cash, Johnny Cash's longtime wife and fellow musician and fellow performer. And what a story she had. Johnny Cash had an incredible story himself. I mean, it wasn't a made-up Hollywood version of the guy coming out of rural Arkansas and making this big splash. Give us the basic details of the Johnny Cash bio. His father, his family had been cotton farmers. They really did fall on completely hard times in the Depression. Tell us that story and how and where Johnny Cash grew up.
Okay. Well, he grew up in Dyess, Arkansas, and, you know, picked cotton very early on in his life, lost a brother to a horrible accident when he was very young, went off to the Air Force. And I think that's one of the things that's very key. He was in, you know, peacetime Air Force over in Germany, working with code breaking operations, as I recall. And I think that that sort of brings a level of sophistication to this farm boy from Arkansas that would really be with him for the rest of his career. You know, took off in the 50s. By the time his third single was out, which was I Walk the Line, he was a major, major star, especially in this region. Went through, you know, a series of addictions, a marriage to June and a conversion experience, and, you know, would come through several times throughout the years. You know, had a phase where he was hanging out with new wave people, and then U2, and then, you know, Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails. I mean, I can't think of anybody in the history of American music that has sung songs from such disparate sources as Cash and over such a long period of time.
It's an incredible arc, but that absolutely inimitable stamp that he put on every song. Let's listen to that, that first big hit, I Walk the Line. So much of what came to identify Johnny Cash is right here. 1956, I Walk the Line.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Brian Mansfield, this was on Sun Records, and here we've got Johnny Cash right away. With there's a kind of love song here, but a very stern package, both in the message and in the voice. I guess it's a song about sexual fidelity. He's going to walk the line with the one he loves. A lot of Cash elements are right there.
Yeah, I mean, that was the basis of the song. He wrote it for his first wife, Vivian Liberto, and but it came to be about more than just marital fidelity. It came to be really the statement of the honesty and integrity he would bring to all of his music throughout his career.
And we read that his mother was a Pentecostal Christian. You can hear Nick Spitzer in that I'll Walk the Line. This is almost right out of the Christian you know, prayer book.
Yeah, it does have a feeling of righteousness and a personal testimony of how things will be. It feels to me that throughout Cash's career, Christianity in a variety of forms is very important. The image of the man in black feels like the preacher, but early on you're hearing these kinds of things. And I gather, and I'm sure Brian can tell us more, that when he first was with Sam Phillips at Sun Records, he wanted to record gospel music, and Phillips didn't think that would sell, so we have other things. So Christianity and a Christian style, as well as some of the, you know, the ways of looking at the world, float through this, even when he's moving into a much broader realm of consciousness than old-style fundamental Christianity.
Is that right, Brian Mansfield, that Johnny Cash wanted to sing gospel, and Sam Phillips said, "That won't sell, my brother"?
That's exactly right. I was talking to the guy that's playing bass on that record, Marshall Grant, earlier today.
Who we're going to hear from in a few minutes, actually.
Yeah, and he said that you know, they wanted to do gospel tunes. Sam Phillips said, "Won't sell. You got to do something else." In fact, I understand that that was the reason that he left Sun Records for Columbia, is because Columbia promised him he could make a gospel record. And sure enough, that was one of the first things he did when he got there.
Nick Spitzer, what about that characteristic sound? And we already heard it there in I Walked on the Boom, da boom, da boom. There's always that kind of slap and that special guitar sound. Can you describe where did that come from? How did he make it? Why did he stick with it?
Well, I mean, it's Luther Perkins on electric guitar, and mm-hmm. mentioned Marshall Grant on bass, and you know, you get that slap bass, and that gives you rhythm. Note that there is no drum on that track, and you know, the Tennessee Three is those three guys.
You really don't need it. There's a lot of percussion on those.
Yeah,
strings.
Right. The percussion is carried in the strings, which is so fascinating because I mean, you could argue that you're getting, you know, a generation into the country string band, electrified, urbanized with some blues, and the drum hasn't yet had to be added to make it rockabilly, rock and roll, and yet it still feels that way, and then
they're tamping on the strings of the rhythm guitar gives it an additional kind of percussive feel. You know, it's not fancy, but it's just perfect. It's like Zen rockabilly. It's the core, and it leads you to all this other rock and roll later on that gets a lot fancier, but I don't think it gets a lot better necessarily.
Brian Mansfield, Johnny Cash had big success rather quickly in the mid-50s, selling millions of records. And then somehow he goes up that success ladder and then in the 60s finds himself really in the grip of a drug problem, amphetamines, barbiturates, that he's pulled out of, as I read it, by June Carter Cash and a return to the old-time religion. Is that right?
That's pretty much correct. Again, when you talk to Marshall, there are stories that Marshall literally had to revive him sometimes. I think sort of Marshall as saving his life and June as keeping him alive. She really worked for him, prayed over him, just stuck with him through very, very hard times, but got him straightened out.
And Nick Spitzer, his commitment to songs that were so often focused on the, I mean, he had this kind of outlaw appeal, and we'll talk about that. He spoke of, hobos and day laborers and people who didn't have much, people who were in prison. Where did that come from? And did Johnny Cash make a knowing lifetime of that? Was it a deliberate commitment on his part? Was he following what sold? Why did it sell?
Well, I think he did what he felt. I don't think he there was any artifice to his posture, and whether, wearing black in the 50s and, people questioned that. And finally he wrote a song to answer it, I guess, by the early 70s. But, those rockabilly guys, they like to be thought of as cool and tough, and they were crossover. And, their big crossover in the social order was to be involved with black music and to have people in their dances move their bodies new ways. And so there is this outlaw posture. It certainly builds on an old American tradition that goes back in blues and country music and just our whole notion of our country is, are we patriots or are we outlaws? I mean, it's in a lot of our culture. And ultimately, Johnny Cash gives way to or helps build a foundation for the musical outlaws, the Willies, the Waylons, and probably now alt-country. But it seems to me that he took it another step. It wasn't just a style and a posture and a set of songs about the down-and-outers or the prisoners and all those people. It was also ultimately kind of a political statement when he sings things like, what is truth? And questions the Vietnam War at a time when it's pretty tough to do that in Nashville, and sings something like, The Man in Black, where he's telling you why he's wearing black. It's because social injustices need to be corrected. So there is the outlaw tradition, the good outlaw, the Robin Hood outlaw, the one that, won't turn anyone out from their home but will only help people. And that runs underneath, I think, through his whole career, and I think that's a populist Southern point of view.
And the artist so clearly, deeply American that he can't really be questioned. He's the bedrock. He's singing. You kind of have to hear it as it is. Brian Mansfield, Johnny Cash had a kind of comeback with Folsom Prison performance later on in the 60s. We're going to hear something from that in just a second. But he sang there in the prison, really cementing that outlaw reputation with June Carter Cash at his side. When was that? Why did it happen?
That was in, I believe, 1968 is when the famous recording was. But he'd been playing in prisons pretty much all of his career. Merle Haggard tells about seeing him in San Quentin in 1958 and that being one of the things that made him decide that that's what he wanted to do. It left a huge impression on him.
That this was a singer who could take it right into the prison and go nose to nose, or really almost arm in arm with the prisoners there, and it all seemed better than good. It seemed great.
He was totally playing to him. I was just listening to this album today because they released a sort of an unedited version of that a couple of years ago, and I mean he's got those prisoners and he's playing to them, and they are just roaring their approval.
Brian Mansfield, Nick Spitzer, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking about Johnny Cash, the Man in Black, dead today at 71. You can join the conversation. What was the magic of Johnny Cash? Did it work for you? And what are your associations with Johnny Cash? Late nights at the jukebox, first kiss in the El Camino. Do they make them like Johnny Cash anymore? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. People gonna stoop and bow. All them women gonna make me teach them what they don't know how. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Johnny Cash.
Well, my daddy left home when I was 3, and he didn't leave much to Ma and me, just this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. Now, I don't blame him because he run and hid, but the meanest thing that he ever did was before he left, he went and named me Sue. Well, he must have thought that it was quite a joke, and it got a lot of laughs from lots of folks. Seems I had to fight my whole life through. Some gal would giggle and I'd get red, and some guy'd laugh and I'd bust his head. I tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue.
Johnny Cash and a Boy Named Sue, his biggest hit, Who'd Have Thunk It, a novelty hit. We're talking tonight with Brian Mansfield, Nashville correspondent for USA Today and author of the forthcoming Ring of Fire, a Johnny Cash biography, and Nick Spitzer, joining us from New Orleans, producer and host of the public radio series American Roots, professor of folklore at the University of New Orleans, talking about the great Johnny Cash, the man in black, dead today at 71. You can join this conversation. Do they make them like Johnny Cash anymore? Is Eminem the new Johnny Cash, the new hard luck truth teller, or is that just glitz? And who's singing for the common man today? Why did Johnny Cash speak to the MTV generation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Brian Mansfield, what did Johnny Cash think about having this fun but really novelty song be his biggest seller, the biggest seller of his career?
Well, the thing that people tend to lose in all of the outlaw and rebel talk about Johnny Cash is that he had an incredible sense of humor. And it was very dark at times, but just an incredibly, incredibly funny guy. When you talk to the people that know him, that's one of the first things that they talk about. So I think he rather got a kick out of it.
Let's talk to someone who knew him very well right now, joining us from Hernando, Mississippi, Marshall Grant, lifelong bass player for Johnny Cash, member of Johnny Cash's first band, the Tennessee Three. Marshall Grant, good evening. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Rob. It's my pleasure.
Thanks so much for being with us. A sad day in the passing of Johnny Cash, but Brian Mansfield is reminding us right now that this was also a man full of humor, full of life. You were right there watching it with him. How do you remember him?
Well, I met him. I'll go back a long ways. I met John when he got out of service in July of 1955, and he and I put the band together. Mm-hmm. Johnny Cash and the Tennessee Two, and then we started on Sun Records here in Memphis, Tennessee. And so every record that you will play tonight, or probably every one that you ever will play, I played bass on.
You were right there. If you think all the way back to those days in the 50s when you, Johnny Cash, were just putting it together, did he have any idea where this might go? As I read his biography, there had been a couple of years there, he was sort of floundering looking for his career, his calling in life.
Well, first of all, when he got out of service, he wasn't going to pursue a career as a singer, as an artist. He went to Kegan's Broadcasting School of Broadcasting here in Memphis to be a disc jockey. Mm-hmm. And then Luther Perkins and I worked at an automobile shop where his brother worked. And when he got out of the service, Roy Cash, his brother, introduced John to myself and to Luther. And Luther and I worked in the same shop, as I said, mechanics. And John, first thing he wanted to do was get married. And he married Vivian Liberto, which is the mother of his four daughters. Right. And then after that, he settled down a little bit, and we started to just playing our instruments at one another's houses until we decided we wanted to try to get on a label. And it's a very in-depth story that we don't have time to tell tonight. Mm-hmm. But then we worked up a couple songs and went to Sound Phillips with Sun Records, and which is Hey Porter and Cry, 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 and they recorded them. And so our career started. I think our biggest... I think we hoped to someday hear ourselves on the radio. And we did.
I guess your dream came true.
Our dream came true one morning about 6 months after we recorded Hey Porter and Cry, 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 and I was going to work, and a disc jockey by the name of Sleepy Eyed John in Memphis played it, and that was the highlight of our life. Mm-hmm. And we thought we had reached the pinnacle at that.
Do you remember how you celebrated that day, Marshall Grant?
Oh, it was on a Monday morning. I was going to work, and I celebrated the day with all of the customers and mechanics and everybody come in. They thought it was the greatest thing in the world because we had heard ourselves on the radio that day. But the next day, all the radio stations in Memphis was playing "Hey Porter, R Cry Cry Cry," and then the next day, even the pop stations picked it up. And before 10 days was gone, you know, it was a big hit record in Memphis, and we didn't know what was happening. You know, we just didn't know. And then so that just sort of had started, and it grew from that.
Johnny Cash was the front man and a big personality, and often famously and openly a troubled personality, a troubled man, troubled with drugs, troubled with, you know, at least the public image. You tell us, Marshall Grant, was he really wrestled with demons. Was that your direct personal experience of Johnny Cash in his life?
Oh, yeah, he made no bones about it. He had a drug problem. There's no question about that. And it started pretty soon after he got out of service. There's no doubt about that. We're dealing with two people when you're dealing with Johnny Cash. John R. Cash is his name.
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with John R. Cash. John R. Cash stands all along as been probably the greatest human being that ever walked God's green earth. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. There's nothing he wouldn't do for anybody. He was the most loving, caring human being on the face of this earth, bar none. Mm. And I mean that. However, he couldn't stay away from him, and he had turned just about everything in his life 180 degrees, and that made him a very troubled person. He was. And, you know, that's just the way it was, and we can't dodge that. And he never did try to dodge it. He admitted it. He was a confirmed drug addict, and he said it publicly.
And what was it that tortured him that took him to look for relief there, Marshall?
Well, looking for excuses, I think, more than anything else. And, you know, the thing that really brought on the drugs more than anything else, after we got started a little bit, and especially after I Walked the Line was released, which was our third record,
big hit,
things blew wide open, and, you know, we were very much in demand worldwide, and we played as many as 250 days a year.
Wow.
And it was tough on him. It was very, very tough. And a friend of his in Nashville one night gave him one of these little pills.
Mm-hmm.
And he just thought it was the greatest thing in the world because he went on the stage, didn't act hard, didn't do this, and he did a good show. But the only thing about it was, for a while it was one pill, and then it went on to two pills, and then on up to a handful of pills, and then things sort of got out of control.
By 1958, he was singing Cocaine Blues.
That's right.
And the rest of the story we know. Marshall Grant, it's so great to get to talk to you. By the end, what was Johnny Cash's frame of mind? Did he feel he had reached his goals? Did he feel like he had put out the artist body of work, the message that he wanted to put out in life?
Well, I think he did. I think he was doing it the way he did it, his way. Everything he did it his way, or should I say, our way. Meaning the Tennessee mm-hmm. 2 or the Tennessee
yep.
3 and him, but he'd do it his way or our way. And sometimes we'd talk about it and do it, but I think he did everything that he wanted to do. The only thing that he wanted to do was keep doing it. And his health got so bad, but he did. If you look at this video, Hurt, after we started in the business in 1955, and here it is 2000 and coming mm-hmm. up on 2004, that's 49 years, and he had a top video.
Nine Inch Nails song.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can tell you, if his health would have hung on and his voice stayed there, he'd be cutting hit records coming and going today, especially if we could have put the Tennessee 3 and Tennessee 2 sound back together, and we could have done that.
And the death of June Carter Cash, did that pull him down?
Oh, yes. After June died, he really had nothing to live for, and his health was so bad. He really had nothing to live for. We all love our spouses. We all love them. But John and June had this special feeling for one another. Very, very, very special feeling. And when she died unexpectedly, it knocked the pops out of all of us.
Mm.
And that was his life. That was his entire life. He lived for her, and she lived for him. And all of a sudden, she's gone, and he had nothing to live for.
Marshall Grant, we're so grateful to you for your intimate memories and for all the music you made with Johnny Cash over so many years. We're sorry for the loss today. We thank you for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
Marshall Grant joining us from Hernando, Mississippi, lifelong bass player for Johnny Cash and member of Johnny Cash's first band, the Tennessee Three. It was hard at the end, but when he was big and he was on. Let's listen. 1956, Folsom Prison.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antone.
Johnny Cash, 1956, Folsom Prison, the famous line, I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. There's the outlaw angle. Nick Spitzer, Brian Mansfield, I guess, Nick, let me go to you here first. I wonder about Johnny Cash's politics. I mean, he said of this concert at Folsom Prison that at the concert in the prison, he experienced, he said, the pain and hopelessness of a soul beaten down, of failure to stay free of the system, of failure to be able to ignore today's pain. But what about his politics? He was there with Bob Dylan. He was there with Richard Nixon. He seemed to sort of walk with everyone in the U.S. political spectrum. Did he have a politics that he took outside of his music?
He walked the line and he blurred the line. It's a very interesting question. I think it's important to remember him in the context of Southern populism, where you have figures ranging from Huey Long to Bill Clinton and many others, who are able to both stand up for the small-town community value idea of America and at the same time think of sort of big things that need to get done in the social order and social justice. It certainly fit with, the Roosevelt New Deal that Cash grew up through as well. Mm-hmm. I think he took some pretty courageous stands in being with the sort of the folk scene of the 60s and doing the What Is Truth, which I'd mentioned. It just seems to me that he wasn't going to let anybody put him in a box, and there's something righteous about that. There's a lot of phony populism out there these days and any day, and he never seemed that way. He always seemed that he went where he honestly felt he needed to be. Democrat, Republican, maybe Brian can tell us his voting card, but I don't know. It seems almost irrelevant. I think populist is the message.
Brian Mansfield, what about it? He did go right across the span there. Did he ever pay a public price for drug use, for the politically tinged criticism in his songs, or was he always protected by this aura of Southern populism, of being the American roots man?
Well, there was a little bit of both. I mean, if you look at what his records did on the radio, they would definitely go up and down, and you'd see about every 6 to 10 years he'd have a big hit record, but then something would happen and he wouldn't get played as much on the radio. But by the same token, there was only so much you could do against Johnny Cash because he was this just overwhelming presence. You knew his integrity. He was just beyond reproach in that sense. He was a powerful enough figure that no matter what some little radio programmer would try to do to him, he was much, much bigger than that.
I'd add that in 1968, when Dylan comes to Nashville and they do Nashville Skyline and Cash sings on there. Mm-hmm. I mean, in that period of time, I mean, there was huge animosity against so-called long hairs coming into country music, whether it was the Byrds or Dylan. And, to record with, the crown prince of social protest, a country record, I mean, that is kind of a political statement. It doesn't mean that he endorses everything the person says, but it basically says we need the freedom to be who we're going to be. And I think that's where populism really operates so brilliantly. It doesn't necessarily require a particular position. It's a social and artistic statement here, too.
But that at a time when many Southern populists might also have a rifle in the pickup rack that wasn't a friendly signal to the Bob
True.
Dylan group of society. Nick Spitzer, Brian Mansfield, stand by. I want to go to Wichita, Kansas, and welcome Johnny Western. He's a DJ for KFDI in Wichita. He worked on the road playing guitar with Johnny Cash for 31 years, did 71 singles and 5 albums with Johnny Cash. Good evening and welcome, Johnny Western.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you guys. And, of course, we've had an enormous day in Wichita, as you can imagine. I did a 5-hour radio show today that goes into 5 states on our straight AM signal. And the phones rang off the hook all day. The newspaper, television people were there. It was just, it was an unreal day, a surreal day, probably, in my life. And I knew this day was coming. I just never wanted it to happen. And now it has, and here we are.
And Johnny Western, what was the message from the people calling in to you on the radio today in 5 states around Wichita? What were you hearing?
Everything from loss of a family member to loss of a complete idol. Johnny Cash was bigger than life. You have to realize this is a very unique man. This is a guy that appealed to everybody. During the almost 40 years that I spent on the road with him, I have seen his records in the most gorgeous homes in Beverly Hills. I've seen him in shotgun shacks in Arkansas. And you talk about blurring the line. I was listening to some of the other folks talking on the show, politically or musically, anything else. He walked the line and probably blurred it from the standpoint that I think he appealed to so many different groups of people. There was no dividing line for Johnny Cash. I know people that claim that they have never liked country music, that absolutely adored him.
And what was it like to be on the road with Johnny Cash? If I'm not wrong, you described a scene of driving down the road in a stretch Cadillac with a U-Haul trailer behind. When was that?
Marshall Grant had a little trailer made. I just heard Marshall on the show. Of course, he was the bass player, and so he had this special trailer made. We call it a teardrop trailer to pull that big bass with, and we all took as little minimal luggage as we could, and we didn't have the big tour buses. Nobody did. You drove in a stretch Cadillac, Johnny and 5 of us, taking turns. Well, we wouldn't let him drive because he's the world's worst driver, but we'd rotate the driving, very few interstates, and making these hundreds of thousands of miles on these tours over the years, and each stretch of new interstate would just seem heaven sent. You know, you get to kind of relax for a little while instead of being out there on a 2-lane road. And, of course, sometimes you play the show, get in the car, drive all night, halfway through the next day, run in, take a shower, shave, do the next show, and maybe the second night get to lay down in a real bed.
Wow.
That's the way the road was. And so if anybody wants to know about why the amphetamines were so popular at that time, they probably saved more lives than anybody will ever appreciate. And, of course, when it got out of hand, it got totally out of hand.
But you didn't drive off the road, and thank heavens for that. Johnny Western, I know that everyone wants a piece of you today. We're so grateful to you for joining us for just a little bit. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's great to be with you guys, and you are remembering an absolute giant. And let me tell you, as my closing thing, we will never see another one like him in our business. Never.
It is sadly easy to believe. Johnny Western, thanks for being with us. Johnny Western from Wichita, Kansas, worked on the road playing guitar with Johnny Cash for 31 years. We're remembering Johnny Cash tonight, the man in black, dead today at 71. What do you hear in that deep, bleak, bare bones voice? We'll go out in this segment with Man Comes Around from 2002. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
At the terror in each sip and in each sup, will you partake of that last offered cup?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're remembering Johnny Cash. Here's Johnny Cash's cover of the U2 song, One.
Is it getting better? Or do you feel the same?
Johnny Cash, 2000, I think it was, 2002, covering U2 song One, which went off the highway there just a moment. But you can hear just in those few seconds, Johnny Cash bringing not just his voice and his career, but even his age into play there. We're remembering Johnny Cash tonight, the man in black, dead today at 71. You can join the conversation. What was the magic of Johnny Cash? Did it work for you? Was Johnny Cash loved because or in spite of his flaws? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Nashville, Tennessee, by Brian Mansfield, Nashville correspondent for USA Today, and from New Orleans by Nick Spitzer, producer and host of the public radio series American Roots. Nick Spitzer, he did a lot of recording very late in his life, and it is so affecting. He somehow brings...
Yeah, they're great recordings. Oh, they are.
Every inch of life and experience and woe is right there.
Yeah, it's a remarkable set of recordings. You know, you're speaking of American recordings, and essentially it's an interesting bridge to a new generation of youth rockers who really, you know, are looking for artists and trying to find out about their own selves. And, you know, here's a man who sings a song, the Nine Inch Nails song Hurt, which is all about, you know, heroin problems, mm-hmm. yet it's got lines in it about the Crown of Thorns, which I think must have attracted Cash a little bit. And here's
well,
a,
that line
sung.
Was actually changed.
Oh, is that right? Hurt was changed yeah. to bring in the Crown of Thorns, Brian?
Well, yeah, there you go. So, mm-hmm. so he's making the connection, which is great to his the Christian symbolism there. But, you know, this is a man who had his problems with drugs. And so when he sings with sincerity. And I think that's incredibly appealing to that audience. And, you know, on top of that, artistically, these are great pieces of work. They yes, some of them, particularly the latter couple albums, he really sounds much the elder. But that's part of... you know, you get the surface with all the flaws, and you know, he's still covering a wide repertoire of material. So it's they're incredible. You know, he works with I guess the guy from Soundgarden, and he's covering a lot of the great sort of singer songwriters in the first record. And to me, the creativity and courage in doing those records is almost astounding.
It is astounding, and you hear it in every bar of that music. Nick Bryan, we've been holding our callers at bay, but I want to bring them in. Jim is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
I just wanted to say that I think that Johnny Cash brought values to America before the country knew it had values. And if you want to look at his courage, you have to look no further than when he did the song Ira Hayes, and radio stations across the country would not play Johnny Cash music. And I think that Marshall Grant could probably tell you, but I think he put an ad in Billboard magazine at that time, and I think I read once that he paid $17,000 to do that.
An ad to say what, Jim?
An ad to express his position and to counter the influence of the recording industry and the radio industry that was stacked up against him at that time.
Jim, he was a fighter. Let us turn to that song, The Ballad of Ira Hayes, and listen to a little bit of it right now. This is from 1964, from the album Bitter Tears, a song themed on Native American struggles, The Ballad of Ira Hayes.
Get around me, people. There's a story I would tell about a brave young Indian you should remember well. From the land of the Pima Indian, a proud and noble band who farmed the Phoenix Valley in Arizona land. Down the ditches a thousand years, the waters grew Ira's people's crops, till the white man stole their water rights and the sparkling water stopped.
Jim in Green Bay, thanks for bringing that one to our attention. Brian Mansfield, Johnny Cash, for some considerable time, actually ascribed to himself Native American ancestry. I think he later recanted. But was he an early artist to pick up that cause?
He really was. And Jim's example of the Billboard ad is interesting. What that Billboard ad said, it was a direct confrontation to radio programmers, and it said, "Where are your guts?"
Because they wouldn't play this song?
Because they would not play this song. He took the ad out in Billboard and said, "Where are your guts?" And the song ended up going to number 3.
And was way up there for many months.
Yeah.
Well, there's a ballad. I want to get more callers in. Brian's calling from Leominster, Massachusetts. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
I just wanted to call. I'm 26 years old, and I've honestly only been listening to Johnny for about 5-6 months at mm-hmm. most. I've known him, you know, I've known who he is my whole life, and I just, my girlfriend called and told me, and I just was kind of stunned, but then I popped a CD in today, and just like a mix CD, and I just broke down and cried. What did it was the wreck of the 90s, the old 97, San Quentin disc, and mm-hmm. I don't know. In reference to what's his influence on people my age and younger, the MTV generation, I'm constantly looking for something alternative to what's being given to us as music today. Johnny Cash is raw, it's real, and it's about just every man, every woman, and I don't know. He just really. The first time I listened to the disc that my friend gave me, a smile crossed my face. It just kind of blew me away.
I think we all know exactly what you mean, and I've had that experience, both the smile and the tears. Nick Spitzer, there's a, and Brian, thank you so much for your call. Nick, there's a song, in, or Brian, I'm not even sure what the name of it is, but I've heard Johnny Cash sing it. I think he may even sing it with June Carter Cash. And it really describes a man who's died and gone to heaven. I think finding his lover there. It's got the lyric, "I'll come running through the shallow water, reaching for your hand."
Far Side Banks of Jordan.
Far Side Banks of Jordan. And in all truth, that one has reduced me to tears. And I thought of it today with Johnny Cash passing on.
Well, that was
interesting.
That
you mentioned the. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, God, I was going to say that was the song that they closed June's funeral with.
Mm. Nick Spitzer?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it's interesting that a young listener who's just getting into Johnny Cash and tapping into the sincerity and the rawness and the commitment to honesty wherever it leads. And then he mentions the wreck of the old 97, which is granted on one of the Live Prison recordings, but that takes you back to old-time country music and the famous song about a train wreck. I mean, all these grand old symbols of Americana and the kind of the ballad tradition reporting on the tragedies. I mean, it allows Cash's ability as a performer and his sincerity allows a lot of people to have access to all these things that they otherwise wouldn't have maybe known about.
Mm. Nick Spitzer, can American music still offer up a performer, an artist like Johnny Cash?
Oh, I think that, I'm an optimist, and I bet Johnny Cash would tell you it's possible to have great new art and performance come along. It's just that it takes time. And, you know, Johnny Cash wasn't the Johnny Cash we know now, even when he had his early hits. I mean, he has spent a lifetime doing all the things he did. And so, you know, popular music tends to just come out new, and then it has to kind of be worn down like the stones in a stream and stand test of time and build audiences and create affections and aesthetics. And I have hope that that's possible, but is there somebody like him, exactly like him? I don't think there is, and there probably never will be somebody just like Johnny Cash.
Well, we'll be waiting for the next to come close to those shoes. In the meantime, we're glad that he doesn't go away, and we're grateful to both of you for being with us tonight. Nick Spitzer, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
Nick Spitzer joined us from New Orleans. He's producer and host of the public radio series American Roots, and Brian Mansfield in Nashville, author of the forthcoming book, Ring of Fire, Johnny Cash Bio. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. And while you're there, you can listen to our program on June Carter Cash and view images of Johnny Cash throughout his career. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I wear the black and mourning for the lives that could have been. Each week we lose 100 fine young men. And I wear it for the thousands who have died, believing that the Lord was on their side. I wear it for another 100,000 who have died, believing that we all...
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Greg Arthur Atlas, Gerald Thomas Atwood, James Audifred.
Today, September 11th, 2003, we gather in sorrow, in remembrance, in our vigilance to never forget the magnitude of what happened here 2 years ago, and in collective resolve to ensure that those who died did not do so in vain.
What you saw until now are only skirmishes, the voice says in Arabic. The true epic has not yet begun.
The costs are large, but it is a battle that we can win, and it is a battle that we must win. Because victory in this battle will be a major victory in the war on terrorism, and a major defeat for the global terrorist networks.
Police here say this was an apparent suicide bombing attack. At least two people are dead. Their cadavers in front of the Cafe Hillel in Emek Rephaim, a very affluent neighborhood in West Jerusalem.
Arafat is an obstacle to the process of reconciliation and peace between Israel and the Palestinian people. Therefore, the government of Israel has resolved to remove this obstacle.
Very, very, very dangerous decision. it will make all the efforts impossible and useless.
I'm disappointed in Joe. My position on Israel is exactly the same as Bill Clinton's. I want to be excuse me, Joe, I didn't interrupt you, and I appreciate you didn't interrupt me.
The governor remains in critical condition on life support in a neurointensive care unit at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. They've indicated that his vital signs are more stable.
This day forward, in the eyes of you people, in the eyes of the church, I am not an alleged victim of clergy abuse. I am recognized. I am a survivor.
And there's a week, the United States marked the second anniversary of the 9/11 attacks with ceremonies across the country. A new video featuring Osama bin Laden came out on the eve of that anniversary. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz takes the president's request for $87 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan to Capitol Hill. Terrorism returns to Israel as a pair of suicide bombing attacks leave at least 15 people dead. Israel responds by saying it intends to remove Yasser Arafat. Thousands of Palestinians rally to Arafat's defense, and brand new Prime Minister Ahmed Korea cautioned Israel against messing with Arafat. At a debate of presidential candidates, Howard Dean and Joseph Lieberman clash over Dean's assertion that the United States needs to rethink its relationship with Israel and Palestinians. Indiana Governor Frank O'Bannon remains in critical condition after a massive stroke on Monday, and the Boston Catholic Archdiocese agrees to pay $85 million to settle clergy sex abuse cases. Jack Beatty, Yasser Arafat, as we sit here tonight, hangs by, it's not clear how thick, but some kind of thread on the West Bank.
Yes, and you have to feel that this would be a catastrophe, just politically and just in its effect upon the psyche of the Palestinian people. Like him or not, he is a symbol of their aspirations toward nationhood, of their independence movement. And to take action against such a symbol when it just seems to me to be folly. And a clear case, it seems to me, where American interests and the interests of the Sharon government diverge. This is not good for the United States, however Mr. Sharon may think it's good for Israel.
But it's not something that Israel would do lightly. They must be sitting there really thinking it through. Colin Powell has said, look, it won't be good for you, Israel, to have this man out on a global stage. And yet, in spite of that, the talk is there. We'll see what happens.
Yes, and of course the awful possibility that he might even be killed. That it would be a kind of martyr. Just frightful to think of how things could have got to this pass. And you know, one wonders what went wrong. I mean, were we more active? Could we have been more active with Mr. Abbas and pushing the roadmap? Were the Israelis too intransigent? Was Mr. Arafat just sabotaging everything? He looked like he was.
And is there a way, is there a place that the United States could even now put its shoulder to move out of this awful impasse?
Yeah, it's hard to see where that shoulder could go. I mean, this is a, let's just hope that doesn't happen.
Well, tough news from Iraq today also. What was it, 8 Iraqi police killed, more U.S. soldiers dying there. Not an easy week, very few easy weeks in the Middle East for some time now.
Yes, the stream of killing that began on 9/11 keeps flowing into Iraq, and the Taliban they warned this week of a war of attrition against our soldiers in Afghanistan.
We long to turn a corner, but it's not easy to see yet. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.